session number 10613, Rule 17.
Charles Burden Taylor, Rule 17. How did the attitude of the guards change or develop? Because this is in the last month of the war.
Yeah.
Did the way they behaved or acted change at all?
Yeah. I think this is a rather difficult one because we were in... This was such a massive camp that we were really within barbed wire in the centre of the conglomeration. But we did hear the one hefty bang at one time just before we were released or liberated, and we gathered that some retreating Germans had gone past the main entrance, the main guardroom area, and had said to the guard there, you know, come on, get yourselves along with us and we'll fight to the end, etc. We fight in the redoubt in Austria and so on, which was a thought at that time, I think. And so the guard said, oh no sir, we're you know, supposed to be guarding this massive camp. And apparently they turned a bazooka on the guard room, and hence this whacking great bang that we heard. So at least they appeared to be sticking to their guns at that time.
Did you notice any change in the way they treated the prisoners?
No. At this time, you see, we were very much enclosed, and I don't recall, for that matter, at this time, were there any counts taking place. We were really just hodgepodge in there. And I think if another 1,000 had come from another direction, then they would have just been marched in and said, get into that area.
So the old system of rigid counting, everything was starting to break down.
The administration was slipping, I think that's the best way of putting it, yep.
So how did the actual liberation come about?
Oh, that in a way was quite amusing, because of the overall story, as far as I was concerned, because the night before, we were told that our overall commandant had heard that the Americans had liaised with the German opposite number and on the outskirts of Moosburg, which was very near to the camp, and sort of given him the option, give in or surrender, and otherwise we're coming in shooting. And apparently the German commander said, no, I'm not giving in, etc. And that was that. And early the next morning, daybreak, we heard the odd shots and saw, oh, I suppose 1,000 yards away, a couple or three tanks held down and the odd shooting towards Moosburg. And then they disappeared. And a certain amount of small arms fire, not much. And then we suddenly saw the Stars and Stripes over one of the churches in Moosburg. Of course, the Americans went wild, cheers and cheers and cheers and so on. And the next thing was we saw a tank coming up the main road through the camp. The next item really of interest was General Patton came in with his pearl-handled pistols to see his boys and went out again.
What sort of impression did he make on you?
Well, just seeing him at a distance and having heard of him, we thought, well, you know, that's him. And I think that if the British had been in that area, I'm quite certain that some army commander would have popped his nose in. And that was that. Jackie Coogan appeared, because they started breaking the wire down between the compounds. Then our wireless came out, and we could literally hear the voice of America coming over. And there were certain roars of mirth. I hope this is not going westwards. But that they reported later that day that the town of Moosburg had been captured, and whatever the army was, it hit the biggest opposition since crossing the Rhine. Well, we thought this was absolutely incredible, because two or three tanks with perhaps half a dozen rounds fired, a little bit of small arms fire, there couldn't have been much opposition. so one felt, I wonder what's been happening since the Rhine. But later on, we did get mixed up with some Americans. We rather pulled their leg, because we asked them how they'd got on and whether the casualties were heavy. And they talked about, I think, losing 3 officers and 15 GIs or something like that. And we said, you know, was that, what do you mean, in the platoon or the company? And they said, oh, no, gee, no, the brigade. Well, since a brigade is about 3,000 men, the casualty list is minuscule. And we felt that they exaggerated a little bit.
How did you feel about being liberated?
I think, in a way, relief. One was always, I think, one thinking one stage ahead. We've now been liberated. We'd had a little bit of, what can I say, bonus. When we arrived there, we got better food, you know, from the point of view of getting these Red Cross parcels, and on a wholesome basis, too. The next thing was to be liberated, but we were thinking one ahead. Right, now we're liberated, how are we going to get back home? And very quickly we were told to be in, and we had to be listed by name, I think, in 25s.
Well, we've just gone to that. I want to ask, did you know many DLI, through the whole of your prisoner of war experience, did you have much contact with other DLI officers?
Not really, except where we were in the same camp. I mean, obviously one had contact then, because then you had contact with anyone, including the other ranks. Occasionally, what happened now? Yes, a thing which I think was jolly nice, and in a way one's got to give the Germans credit for this. When we moved into, when we finally got to Weinsberg, somehow or other, some of the prisoners who'd been in Germany for 5 years, since the France days of 1940, heard that there were certain people of ours, and we got a batch of, I think mainly tobacco and cigarettes, from Camp 7B, I think it was, where the bulk, as far as I'm concerned, of the DLI officers were. And these were shared out amongst our DLI chums, which was rather nice. But we had no direct contact between camps.
Right, you were saying they put you in batches of 25. This is at Moosburg.
Yeah. Well, the main point was that we were going to be moved out to a town nearby, Landshut, and from there we'd be flown to Reims in France, and then we'd be flown from there to UK. And the main worry was that they would be put in 25s, but if anyone felt ill or went sick and fell out of that 25, then that particular group or plane would go right to the bottom. So nobody felt like feeling ill, and that was that. Ultimately, we were taken to Landshut and onto a massive, very level grass field, a satellite airport, I suppose, or aerodrome. And there we waited and waited. Beautiful sunny day, it really was. And of course, we waited all day, and unfortunately, no planes came. So we were taken back to Landshut, where the American who was looking after us all gave a block of flats, I guess a couple of hours or an hour, to clear out, to allow us to go in. And at this time, there were one chap and myself, and we found that when we got into this flat area, we were more crowded than we had been, believe it or not, in the PW camps, and it was going to be a jolly sight more uncomfortable. So we decided that we'd go out and forage near to the flats, and knocked on a door. No, in the first instance we met up with some of the sort of B echelon American troops and had a chat with them, and had some fried eggs with them, if I remember rightly, which was a nice change. And in them realizing the situation as we had, they were full about full of getting us more food and cans and We didn't know what K rations were then, but they produced those as well. So, in effect, from that chit-chat, we came away with a quite a lot to eat, including coffee. And so we then moved on and knocked at the door of a house, and slightly scared people answered the door, and in a halting German we asked if we could have some water, hot water, and could we come in, because we wanted to make some coffee. And cutting a long story short, we stayed there, A, because it was near the flats, B, it was a jolly sight more comfortable, and gave these people, finally, in a way, broke down their fear that we weren't going to rape the daughter or the mum or whatever, and established quite a nice little rapport. Next thing was, of course, that we went out, were taken out in trucks to this satellite airfield, and once again the plane didn't come, so we were back again, so we went back to our house, and I think we had 3 or 4 days there. And by that time, they were making sort of apple strudel for us. So we got on a very good, diplomatic basis. And then finally the planes did come.
How did the civilians generally react?
At that time, there were very, very few about. I think that the war had just passed them by, and perhaps, the American soldiers were still there. And I think that they may well have expected any time now there will be more. And of course, don't forget all the propaganda of what the Americans would do, particularly what the Russians would do. I mean, everyone would be raped and all the rest of it. And from a propaganda point of view, the Americans and the British weren't all that far behind, so that everyone had to fight to the last and so on and so forth. So that very few people wandering about the streets. And for that reason, in a way, it was rather a pleasant experience meeting up with these people in this house that we linked up with. Later on, of course, certain orders were issued by Montgomery as to how one would conduct oneself, the German people. And from our point of view, of course, there was no fraternization until, even by soldiery, certainly not by officers, until about mid-1946, I think.
Well, that hadn't come in then?
No, not at that time.
So you were 3 or 4 days?
Yes, in Landshut, yes. And then we took off, and that was a heck of a thrill, because we really felt, here we go. And we landed in darkness, actually, in Reims, and were very quickly put onto Lancaster's, and I had a tremendous thrill being in the nose end, where the bomb aimer was, so one could get a good view of everything that was going on. And we took off and landed somewhere in Buckinghamshire, I'm not quite sure where. And I think perhaps the first thing that happened was the indignity of being squirted with delousing powder, down one's pants, up one's blouse, in one's hat, and round one's hair, and so on. Which was a very fair precaution, I suppose.
Had you got any lice? No. Got rid of the ones you'd had?
Well, the ones we had, I never had any lice. But, as far as I was concerned, what we had at Moosburg were literally bites all over the place, which we regarded as being flea bites. But I suppose that's the equivalent of being lousy. I don't know.
But you were de-loused?
We arrived at the Air Force base, and into a massive hangar, and then we sat down to have something to eat, and there's a waft, I've never forgotten this at the end of my life, because there was a waft of very exotic perfume or something came round our heads first, and a rather seductive voice said, welcome back, is there anything we can do for you? Which, having been out of circulation for 3 and a bit years, might have been a difficult question to answer. But they were absolutely first class. We got, I don't know what the meal was, but it was in our own, we had our own feet on our own country. That I think was a great thing. And a splendid civilized meal with civilized people. And free, I think that's the main thing. And the next thing was to be popped back into trucks again, motor trucks, and taken off to a camp near Amersham. that I seem to remember going through Amersham, and this was on VE Day, and of course everybody was whoops and joy and dancing in the streets and so on. It was a pity we couldn't have just hopped out and joined them at that time. But we went up to a camp, and really the whole idea was to get us into bed, I think, straight away, but we were told that in a tented mess, if you wanted there was some sort of bread and butter and things that, if you wanted to have a little bite to eat of some sort, off you went. And then the next morning we were ushered in to really be kitted out, what can I say, everything, just kitted out, meal rat, medal ribbon sewn on, ration cards given, leave passes given, railway warrants to get home, and in other words, to push us out on the road again, to go on leave.
So you went back on leave?
Yeah.
And what sort of reception did you get from your family? They must have been pleased.
Well, the... yes. The... what happened, actually, really, I went by train. I think we were taken by motor to Uxbridge. And so I went by underground to finally end up at Hawley in Sussex, where my wife, my then wife, which is my first wife, picked me up with young Angela, whom I hadn't seen, at the station, and took me home to Copthorne in Sussex. And I suppose one says that the reception was just the sort of reception you expect. Very quiet little child, mainly because I mean, she'd only heard from Mum that Dad was somewhere over there. This was his photograph and that sort of thing. But no, we got on very well together.
Must have been very strange for you that a child would be about three then.
Something like that, yeah, that's right. And it's a number of years to have been without a parent, one parent, and just be told verbally. And I think three, it gets to the point where it must start thinking, now, how am I going to react, or what's this fellow going to be like? And I don't know, we had quite a lot of fun after that.
So there was no trouble
in nope,
establishing
nope.
a relationship. How long were you back home before you... Because you carried on in the army.
Yes, that was a time of really great decision, although it's got nothing to do with the army life. But what was I going to do? Because I had been with Thomas Headley's, which is now Procter & Gamble, and they guaranteed our jobs back for us. My father-in-law at that time said that I could work and become a director of his consultancy firm, and of course the third option was to stay in the army, if I was allowed to. Well, right at the beginning of the war, as a youngster, and at that time after school, I found it very difficult to know what I wanted to do. And soon then we were called up. I remember saying to myself, Major, look, if we're still together and still in one piece and I can stay in the army, that's what I must do, that I should have done this ages ago. And so I tried for a regular commissions board, which I took in 1945. And I suppose it may well have been that one didn't expect to get through, having been away for 3 years. But
how did they assess you, whether you were...
This was great. It was fun, actually, because it was 3 or 4 days of which we had, I think, one afternoon writing, and the other rest of the time was doing things. And the writing things, I think, were one or two of these, I forgot what they call them, but you know, sort of 125 questions in 20 minutes, where you rattle through. One or two things, you know, what would your pattern be for life? What would you expect under these certain, that certain circumstance and so on? The rest of it was really on the basis of your hair face. You've all got your toggle ropes round your waist. You've got so much scaffolding. That area is covered with mustard. You've got half a dozen oil drums. Get yourselves across. That was a bundle of you. I think there were about 18 of us. That was one side of it. And then you'd possibly be split into two, and a leader of each appointed to do a certain task. There are other things which were very much individual, if you like, on the question of getting up through assault course or that type of thing. That, if you like, was essentially individual, but the one where you were as a bundle of 7 or 8 or 18, a group given a task, and of course they would pick out the leaders who showed, or those people who showed a little bit more initiative than others. So that sort of thing. And
where did this all take place at?
This took place near, again, that's just on the tip of my tongue, but very, very much, I mean, in UK, and not very far from Watford, but the exact name of the place I can't remember.
Were you given any, I mean, this is any psychological help or advice, because you've been a prisoner for 3.5 years, that has been a bad effect.
Yes.
Did they have a look at you to see whether you were all right?
Not at that time, no. Now we must go back to when I was coming really off leave. The first thing that happened to us was to send us to Beckenham, I think it was, where we went into a big house. There must have been perhaps 18, 20 of us there. And the first day we assembled, and a trick cyclist came in and took one look around us, and he said, "Now, gentlemen, I want you to understand that not one of you is normal in here." So, of course, we all sort of looked at one another in slight amazement or disbelief, and until he went on to explain that some of you have been behind wire for 3 months, 3 years, 5 years, for a variety of periods, and he said it's a completely unnatural situation for anyone to be under, whereby you've had to obey everything all the way along the line, you haven't had a chance to hit back or really answer back, you have just been, shall we say, all mentally and if not physically tied hand and foot. And he said, "But be quite assured that you will all be quite normal in a greater or lesser degree of time. It won't be all that long." So we were thus assured. And thereafter it was really a question of telling us what we would be doing, asking us what we'd like to do, for that matter. I, for my side, wanted to get back to my regiment as quickly as possible. And that was, in fact, my next posting.
Did you feel normal yourself? Did you agree with him?
No, I don't think we really did agree, because we weren't consciously abnormal.
Did you notice any peculiar habits you picked up, or...?
No. I can't think of anything that really would count as being abnormal. I mean, I think you'd better get my first wife to find and we parted company later on, so there must have been something in that. But I mean, that takes two sides. It takes two sides to make a wedding. It takes two sides to make a breakaway.
So you'd had this sort of psychoanalyst type thing at the reception centre, and then you went for your regular commission.
Later on, that's right.
What happened after? You were accepted.
Yep. No, I'm very chuffed about that, because there were only two of us who were accepted out of the 18. And, which I was very surprised. I don't know. I was very surprised. I was very gratified, too, because it's something I wanted to do. And maybe that could have been something which sort of shone through without me knowing anything about it.
So you were sent to a transit camp to the 4th Holding Battalion.
That's right. Well, that's right.
Was that at Sedgefield?
Sedgefield in County Durham, that's right. Just outside, or near to Hartlepool.
And what were you doing there?
Really, very, very little. We did any, bakshi officer's duties, like a daily duty officer, but basically we were in transit and not meant to be there for any great time. And so you weren't really committed to anything definite. Because they had the staff to run the camp, and of course there were a number of officers in transit going from point A to point B. So basically, unless they were likely to be there for a while, shall we say, awaiting a ship, if they were going to the Far East or something, then...
Was this 4th holding battalion, was that related to the DLI, or was it just a normal...
No, just a holding battalion, yep.
And from there you got a posting, I think, to the 6th DLI.
To the 6th DNI, that's right. Where was I? Cross Hills in Yorkshire, where I took over a company, and just normal company duties, really, and normal company training.
How did you feel about being sent to the 6th, the black button bastard?
Yeah, well,
that's not mine. No,
that's going back to pre-war anyway.
Yeah.
But I think the great thing was that we were going back to soldiering. In other words, we were getting back to being getting back to normality again. And I can't remember, it may well have been that I couldn't get back to the 8th Battalion, which was my original battalion pre-war. I think I probably would have asked for the 8th Battalion, but I remember certainly saying that originally I want to go back to my regiment, and that was that. And the first one to be was the 6th Battalion, and thereafter, after a short while, I moved off to the race course at Doncaster, because it's really a bit soul destroying, but to help. I mean, basically, the European war was over. And I think by this time, even the Japanese war, because that was August. And my company was gathering potatoes. And it was a bit of a soul destroying. The chaps went off in lorries each day to various farms and to gather in, harvest the potatoes. And the only real thing about that was I was completely independent and well away from battalion headquarters, so you're running your own thing.
Which company were you with? Was
sixth? Ooh, sixth. I think it was C Company, but frankly, I can't remember.
So, how long were you with them?
Oh, relatively short space of time, because very shortly afterwards there was some scheme, I can't remember what they called it, but whereby you swapped places with someone who was in Rhein Army, and I went over. I don't know who came to replace me, but I went over to 9 DNI in Germany.
Now, what was your rank at this stage? Were you still a captain, or were you promoted at some point?
No, I was still a captain. I didn't get my majority until I took over a company in Germany.
Which company? This was to the 9th DNI.
No, yes.
And which company did you take?
That one was support company. That's the one with anti-tank machine guns, mortars, and assault pioneers.
And where were you? Where were the knights when you joined
them? Originally, I met up with them at a place called Unna, but really we moved very, very quickly. In fact, it could have been in the middle of the move when I arrived, to a place called Hamer, which was near Iserlohn. That's the nearest biggest town, anyway, in the Ruhr.
Now, what was life like at this time? Did you go out in late 45, or was it into 46 by the time you got there?
Early 46.
And what was it like in Germany? It was still obviously in a state.
That's for sure. The I think one of the most interesting things was the fact that we had going maps. It sounds rather like the desert, because going maps in the desert, you couldn't go through soft sand. It had to be avoided. And as far as Germany was concerned, of course, there were so many bridges blown that if you want to go from point A to point B, you certainly couldn't guarantee to go in a straight line. You may have to go some miles south to get a bridge that was not blown, or where a Bailey bridge or some other type of bridge had been built. I mean, across the Rhine, there were only certain crossing points. You couldn't get across any of the pre-battle bridges.
Had the streets been cleared of rubble?
To a varying degree. Very much a varying degree. Generally speaking, you would get away through. But, I mean, a lot of rubble all over the place. But shall we say the centre of a street would be tidied. But either side there'd be rubble, and And that you got all over the place.